Today is Monday, August 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Protests continued in Minsk opposing last week's election results.
So there's anger over, of course, this rigged election, but also about the state policing that came afterward.
Plus, New Zealand postpones its election over coronavirus concerns.
The Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says the new date on 17 October gives parties the opportunity to plan their campaigns around any COVID-19 restrictions.
And the Democrats start their national convention this week. We'll have those stories and more next. Belarusians chanting "Step down" and "Long live Belarus" filled central Minsk Sunday in the biggest protest so far against what they said was the fraudulent re-election a week ago of longtime President Alexander Lukashenko. Charles Maines is in Moscow, and he's been following the situation.
What we've seen is these crowds just keep getting bigger and bigger. To bring us up to speed today, I mean, so yesterday we had this massive, in fact, the largest rally in the history of Belarus since it became independent from the Soviet Union, somewhere between 200,000 to maybe some people say 500,000. I guess we can debate the numbers, but it was an enormous crowd. And more interesting, also in contrast to Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko tried to rally his own forces. He had a demonstration in the central square in Minsk. He got about 5,000 people there. So just the numbers alone seem to speak to where the dynamics are headed. Lukashenko looks in trouble. Today we had news that several of the biggest factories in Belarus, these are factory workers who are traditionally Lukashenko's supporters, they're going on strike as of today, demanding he resign. And he also gave, during this fiery speech yesterday, he said he was, you know, certainly not planning to give up power. He blamed NATO forces for trying to overthrow the government and called his opponents rats. But if we look at the actual dynamics of what's happening here, I think you've seen this opposition really self-organize. I mean, there isn't really a leader there. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who was the main opposition candidate during the election, she got formally 10% of the vote, but a lot of people think she won. She fled to neighboring Lithuania under threat to her family. She's been making some addresses from there. But essentially what you see is these massive crowds of Belarusians kind of policing themselves, organizing themselves, and coming out in massive, massive numbers.
But Lukashenko is also cracking down fairly hard on those opposing him.
That's right. And that's the other dynamic here is that so there's anger over, of course, this rigged election, but also about the state policing that came afterwards. So we had this police crackdown against demonstrators, peaceful demonstrators, I should add, where people were arrested. We had upwards of 7,000 arrests. And people once inside the jails came out, when they finally came out with horrific stories of torture, beatings. And in fact, during this rally Sunday, you saw all these people holding up either photographs of, you know, bruised bodies with these just massive welts on them from these beatings by police batons, or people themselves just standing there in shorts so you could see these welts and bruises on their legs. So I think this anger over this crackdown is also fueling a lot of the anger towards Lukashenko these days.
Is there concern in Minsk and elsewhere in Belarus about the involvement of the military to kind of quell the protests? I did see a report that Russia has extended an offer to Lukashenko to offer military assistance if he requested it.
Right. And I think that's the other dynamic here is that although Lukashenko seems to have lost any kind of mandate with the public, he still seems to have at least enough control over the security forces and the army. You mentioned, so that's one big concern. Although I should add that we've seen, you know, this violence that was sort of characterized the first 3 or 4 days after the election, that seems to have quelled a bit. We're not seeing that, and that seems to be by design. I think he's realized that this is only going to inflame passions against his government. You mentioned Russia. We don't really know what that means. I think it's clear that Lukashenko is trying to get Russia involved. He's inviting the option and trying to suggest that not only is NATO trying to overthrow his government, but overthrow the Russian government. He's sort of trying to bait Russia in. I think there's a sense when you talk to observers here that Vladimir Putin may not go for that. There's no love lost between these two leaders.
Charles Maines reports from Moscow. The global coronavirus pandemic has infected nearly 21.7 million people and killed over 775,000. On Monday, India reported its COVID-19 death toll has surpassed 50,000 after it confirmed more than 900 new dead in one day. South Korea, which previously saw success in driving down the number of new infections, now is working to slow an outbreak around Seoul, where several churches are linked to infection clusters. Japan, home to the world's third largest economy, is the latest to show the economic impact of the pandemic, which caused governments across the world to institute restrictions that have severely hampered economic activity. The government released data Monday showing that the Japanese economy shrank at an annual rate of 27.8 between April and June. The decline is the biggest since comparable data began being recorded in 1980. France says it will impose retaliatory quarantine measures against Britain after London said it will place restrictions on travelers coming from both France and the Netherlands. Nicolas Pinot takes things from here.
French authorities warned the country will apply reciprocal measures following the announcement by Britain that anyone traveling from France will have to submit to a 14-day self-isolation requirement upon arrival. The British measure came into force on August 15th. Since then, 160,000 British holidaymakers rushed to get home. Eurotunnel, which operates the drive-on-train service for cars through the Channel Tunnel, warned travelers not to turn up without a reservation at its terminal in the French port of Calais after a last-minute surge in bookings. French Junior Minister for European Affairs, Clément Beaune, said it was a British decision we regret and which will lead to a reciprocal measure. He said he hoped for a return to normal as soon as possible. The Netherlands, which was also added to the quarantine list, said it would now advise against all non-essential travel to Britain, though arrivals from Britain will not need to quarantine. Britain had no quarantine measures in early stages of the pandemic, but in June imposed a blanket self-isolation requirements on all arrivals. Weeks later, it carved out travel corridors, which exempted travelers from certain countries from quarantine. However, the measures were reintroduced for arrivals from Spain in late July, catching airlines by surprise, as well as thousands of Britons leaving for their holidays. The government then reimposed quarantine for travelers from Andorra, Belgium, and the Bahamas last week. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
New Zealand's general election, due next month, has been postponed 4 weeks because of a spike in the number of coronavirus cases. And in Australia, a state of emergency has been extended as the state of Victoria records another grim milestone. Phil Mercer has these updates.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern had been under increasing pressure to delay an election due in September. Most campaigning has been halted by a spike in coronavirus cases in Auckland, which is under a two-week lockdown. Ardern says polling day will now be on October 17.
Moving an election date, especially this late in the electoral cycle, is a significant decision. Our resurgence plan is in full swing. There are high levels of testing, rapid contact tracing, alongside the level 3 restrictions that are all designed to limit the spread of the current cluster. However, it is clear that the re-emergence of COVID in Auckland at the beginning of the formal campaign period has been cause for concern.
The source of the infections is still a mystery. New Zealand's main opposition National Party had argued the election should be delayed until November or even into next year. They believe restrictions on campaigning because of the pandemic would give the Prime Minister an unfair advantage. Jacinda Ardern had been widely praised for crushing the virus and is expected to win another term. But her opponents hope she will lose some of her luster once hardships caused by the Auckland lockdown begin to bite. Across the Tasman Sea, Australia has recorded its deadliest day of the pandemic so far. 25 people have died in the state of Victoria in the past day. 282 new coronavirus cases have been reported, prompting some optimism by disease experts. Professor Jodie McVernon, the Director of Epidemiology at the Doherty Institute in Melbourne, says daily infection rates in Victoria are going down.
We've obviously been in a situation just a few weeks ago where we were seeing numbers in the 700s. Those numbers are now coming down into the 200s or maybe around 300. And with that, We're seeing fewer numbers of contacts of cases being reported. We're seeing less clusters and outbreaks being reported. And overall, the number of healthcare worker infections are coming down. And all of those are really positive indicators.
Victoria has also extended a state of emergency for another month. The city of Melbourne remains in lockdown and other restrictions apply across the entire state. Organisers of Sydney's New Year's Eve fireworks are under increasing pressure to cancel the famous display because of the pandemic. The City Council is conceding that it may not be responsible to encourage large crowds to the glittering spectacle. The City of Melbourne could also lose the rights to host the Australian Rules Football Grand Final, the nation's biggest sporting event, in October because of the COVID-19 crisis. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said on Saturday that all indications were that his country had reached the peak of COVID-19 infections. In the televised address, he announced a sweeping removal of lockdown restrictions on the economy.
The move to level 2 means that we can remove nearly all of the restrictions on the resumption of economic activity across most industries. Economic activity will be allowed with the necessary and appropriate stringent health protocols and safety precautions in place.
VOA's Anita Powell is in Johannesburg and explains what's been the impact of the restrictions so far and how lifting them may help.
Right before the president spoke, the government also renewed their state of disaster proclamation, which gives the government a few extra powers because we're in a state of disaster. And there was a lot of consternation over that. You know, why would the government extend a state of disaster when they're going to ease the lockdowns? And some analysts said, well, this is pragmatic. If the government needs to revert and go back to a harsher level of lockdown, the state of disaster would enable them to do that without too much extra paperwork.
So, Anita, can you kind of explain what the impact has been for the restrictions placed on South Africa?
Well, I think across the board, both from the economists and from people on the street, everybody agrees that this has had a disastrous effect on the South African economy. This is a country that already has about 30% unemployment. And this lockdown, which started in late March and has been easing ever since, has really disenfranchised a lot of South Africans, especially those who work in the informal sector. So the lifting of these restrictions, the easing of these restrictions, has been met with approval by many South Africans who say, you know, we need to heal the economy. It's time to open back up.
Can you take a moment and explain why there were restrictions placed on alcohol and tobacco consumption?
Let me address them separately. So First of all, the tobacco ban has been in place since March 27th, which was when the lockdown started. And that was because health officials who advised the government said that tobacco smoking was a serious risk to people with COVID. And if they could just eliminate that, then they could improve people's chances, if they did contract COVID. So that was the rationale from the beginning. And that has been the case until tomorrow, when you can again buy tobacco products in South Africa after 5 months. So that was the rationale for that. And the government was very firm on that. Even though they were taken to court over this unsuccessfully, they finally managed to lift the restrictions. As for alcohol, the alcohol ban, the rationale behind that is that alcohol contributes to a disproportionate number of hospital admissions in South Africa. A lot of these, the health minister says, are because of violent crime that arises.
With these rollbacks, what exactly is going to be allowed and what milestone needs to be reached next for further relaxation?
So, as for the first question, you'll now be able to purchase alcohol between the hours of 9 and 5. On weekdays at local stores. So many people probably won't be able to make it to the store during their workday, which the government, I think, hopes will lead to lower consumption. President Cyril Ramaphosa very carefully did not lay out any more goalposts and say this is what we're going to do next. He was very careful about that, and he's been careful about that since about June when we entered level 3 of lockdown. He's been very careful about not saying when this is going to end or what this will take.
Anita Powell is VOA's South Africa correspondent. And coming up later,
a Japanese bulk carrier that ran aground off the coast of Mauritius, causing what some scientists are calling the island's worst ecological disaster, has broken apart.
This is VOA News.
to science in a minute.
NASA's new Mars rover Perseverance is on its way to the red planet. The rover is scheduled to touch down in the Jezero crater, located slightly north of the Mars equator, sometime in February 2021. Tagging along with Perseverance is a self-piloting helicopter called Ingenuity that is hoped will perform the first powered flight on Mars. Ingenuity recently got an in-flight checkup and had its power system batteries recharged to a 35% charge level. The team decided that keeping the helicopter's batteries charged at a low level would be best for its health during the journey to Mars. According to NASA, the rover contains a suite of state-of-the-art instruments that will look into the red planet's ancient history for not only clues of a habitable environment, but for indications of past microbial life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. In the United States, the Democratic National Convention gets underway tonight. The in-person event was scheduled to take place in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but because of the coronavirus pandemic, it's gone virtual. VOA's Kane Farabaugh gives us this preview.
So this was all really supposed to be happening in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Wisconsin being a battleground state, one of these states that both Republicans and Democrats view as a must-win state on the path to the White House. And it is a state that President Trump narrowly won in 2016 and was the state that helped him secure enough support to win the White House. So both parties view the state as a crucial win, and that's partially why the Democrats have decided to host their convention in the biggest city in the state. But because of the growing coronavirus concerns and the spread of COVID-19 throughout the country, all of this now has turned to virtual or online or television programming from remote locations. So Milwaukee being the centerpiece of this traditionally showpiece event that happens, in this case, for the Democrats in Milwaukee, it's not happening. Milwaukee has almost now become a forgotten or altogether irrelevant part of the conversation. And so what Democrats are going to do now is meet virtually. Instead of having hundreds of delegates come to Milwaukee from around the country, I mean, Milwaukee was expecting about 50,000 people to come to the city to, you know, cover or participate in this convention. None of those people are coming, save for a few. So now everybody is spread out across the country, and in order to meet, they're going to do so virtually. They're going to set up Zoom meetings or conference calls by video. They're going to try to profile some of the key concerns that they want to address on the campaign trail leading up to the November election. They're going to decide some of those things through these virtual meetings. And really what's at stake for them is deciding what tack the party is going to take in taking on President Trump and the Republicans as they gear up their campaign messaging for the fall campaign.
Of course, Kamala Harris and Joe Biden are going to be speaking during the convention. But who are some of the other big names that are scheduled to appear?
Well, one in particular who is going to speak is not a Democrat at all. It's a Republican, former Ohio Governor John Kasich. He'll be making a big speech in support of Joe Biden for president. That's remarkable because he is not a member of the party that's going to nominate Joe Biden to be president. He is from the opposition. Also, too, you'll have some of the other candidates who were challenging Biden for the nomination.
And the Obamas, correct?
That's absolutely right. And having the former president standing by his side at this point, as former Vice President Joe Biden stood by President Obama's side for 8 years in the White House, is a significant moment for Biden. It's a sign of support as well. It's also tying him to an era that many Democratic voters were fond of, the Obama presidency, and also to Michelle Obama, the former First Lady. She is one of the most popular women in the world.
That was VOA's Kane Farabaugh. The United States Postmaster General is under fire for making changes that slowed deliveries ahead of this November's election, when up to half of all voters in the country could try to cast ballots by mail. Reuters' Zachary Goldman has that story.
Top Democrats in the U.S. Congress on Sunday called on the U.S. Postmaster General to testify about changes critics warn could disrupt the counting of election ballots. The head of the U.S. Postal Service, Louis DeJoy, has come under fire, including weekend protests outside his Washington home over cost-cutting measures ahead of the November 3rd contest when up to half of voters could cast mail ballots due to the health crisis. In a joint statement, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and Carolyn Maloney, who chairs the House Oversight Committee, said, quote, "The Postmaster General and top Postal Service leadership must answer to the Congress and the American people as to why they are pushing these dangerous new policies that threaten to silence the voices of millions just months before the election." Democrats have accused U.S. President Donald Trump of trying to hamstring the cash-strapped Postal Service to suppress mail-in voting. Trump himself on Thursday said he had held up talks with Congress over a fresh round of coronavirus stimulus funding to block Democrats from providing more funds for mail-in voting and election infrastructure. The Postal Service last week warned states that there is, quote, significant risk voters in 46 states will not have their ballots postmarked and delivered in time to be counted. Election officials are bracing for a deluge of mail ballots, as many states have made it easier to vote by mail to address concerns about public gathering during the coronavirus pandemic.
Zachary Goldman reports for Reuters News. And the bulk carrier that ran aground in Mauritius, causing a major oil spill, has broken apart. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
The MV Wakashio struck a coral reef in July, and earlier this month spilled around 1,000 tons of oil into waters that are home to endangered corals, fish, and other marine life. The Mauritius National Crisis Committee said in a statement that at around 4:30 p.m., a, quote, "major detachment of the vessel's forward section was observed," adding that a towing plan would be implemented. Following a government request for assistance, India, which has close ties with Mauritius, dispatched over 30 tons of technical equipment and material to supplement the country's salvage operations, according to a government statement on Sunday.
That was Reuters' David Doyle, and you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been almost 50 years since the United States began a dialogue that led to the opening of relations with China. We imagined engagement with China would produce a future with bright promise of comity and cooperation, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. That promise turned out to be false. Over the decades, greater prosperity did not bring expanding freedom at home in China or ameliorate China's threat abroad. The Chinese Communist Party abused the Chinese people's human rights. It claimed more and more territory in the South China Sea. It sought to intimidate the Friends of Taiwan and crush the liberty-loving people of Hong Kong. It made the world's key waterways less safe for international commerce. And as the price of admission to doing business in China, it insisted that Western companies transfer technology to potential Chinese rivals and remain silent in the face of horrific human rights violations. While the United States opened its arms to Chinese citizens, Secretary Pompeo said, the Chinese Communist Party sent propagandists and spies to American press conferences, research centers, and universities. It ripped off our prized intellectual property and trade secrets, causing millions of job losses across America. The Chinese Communist Party must change, he declared. It must start embracing the goals that President Donald Trump has set for fairness and reciprocity. We must also engage and empower the Chinese people, a dynamic, freedom-loving people who are completely distinct from the Chinese Communist Party.
For too many decades, our leaders have ignored, downplayed the words of brave Chinese citizens and warned us about the nature of the regime we're facing. And we can't ignore it any longer.
But changing the CCP's behavior cannot be the mission of the Chinese people alone, said Secretary Pompeo. Free nations have to work to defend freedom.
I call on every leader of every nation to start by doing what America has done, to simply insist on reciprocity, to insist on transparency and accountability from the Chinese Communist Party. For too long, we let the CCP set the terms of engagement, but no longer. Free nations must set the tone. We must operate on the same principles.
If we don't act now, said Secretary Pompeo, ultimately the CCP will erode our freedoms and subvert the rules-based order that our societies have worked so hard to build. Securing our freedoms from the Chinese Communist Party is the mission of our time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.